So we are in a third week of a series called The Five Dysfunctions of a Family. And the common question is, why are you only talking about five? Because there's lots of different dysfunctions of a family, an unhealthy family. And so what we're doing is we're taking 5 weeks and we're looking at four generations of Abraham and Sarah's family, right? And we're just tracing their lineage down for four generations and seeing what kind of dysfunctions pop up. And I've cherry-picked a few to focus on. So the first week, we talked about Abram and Sarah and how God gave them a promise to give them a son, right? And through that son, there would be many, 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 many more descendants that would bless the whole earth. Well, years and years and years go by, and there's no son after the promise. So we saw that Abraham and Sarah, they really wanted a son. They wanted to get this thing going. And it seems like they put family above God. And so we have to have a son. We've been waiting on God. Let's just take matters in our own hands. And Abraham sleeps with his wife's maidservant, and they have a son that way. And so what we said was, the best way to keep from making your family an idol, because that's what I was kind of saying that Abraham and Sarah did. They made family the idol. They put family above God and trusting in God to provide. So the best way to keep from making your family into an idol is not to love them less, which was, that's what you would think. I need to love my family less instead of making them an idol. The way to keep from making them an idol is to love them more. And the only way, the best way to love family more is to love God more. And that is true about anything. You could take family out and put anything in there, right? Because God has to be number one. Nothing needs to come before God. And the moment we put something else in front of God, in place of God, more important than God, then you can be assured dysfunction is coming your way as a family. And then last week we talked about Abraham's son, Isaac, his wife, Rebekah, their sons, Jacob and Esau, the next generation, second and third generation. And we saw that, man, this family has a dysfunction of deceit and dishonesty. And they did not have open lines of communication at all. They kept secrets from each other. And that lesson is, dysfunctional families are deceptive, but healthy families encourage and chase after, they talk, they trust, and they're transparent in their communication. That's a sign of a healthy family. So today, we're looking at a little bit more about this third generation, Jacob and Esau. And we're going to be in Genesis chapter 28 through 33. We're not going to read all that, but that's the where the story takes place. So before we get into chapter 28, let me tell you what happened after, you know, Jacob, last week, we saw he stole the blessing, he stole the birthright from his brother Esau. And he was deceptive. Well, Esau, at the end of chapter 27, at the end, Esau is angry. And he says, I'm going to kill my brother. As soon as my father dies, I'm going to kill my brother. Where Rebekah must have her ear to the wall all the time. She must just be listening for something because she overhears this. And she comes to her son Jacob. She says, you better get out of Dodge because Esau wants to kill you. Here's what we're going to do. Let's come up with this plan. I'll tell your father, okay, we don't want you to marry any of the women around here. We want you to go back home and marry somebody from our lineage, somebody in our family, okay? So your brother married some Hittite women, and they've been nothing but trouble. So we want you to go to Padam Aram, about 400 miles away, to where Abraham is from, and he has people there, and we want you to find a wife there. Jacob says, that sounds like a good plan. So they go to Dad. Dad says, yes, that's a good plan. So in chapter 28, Isaac blesses Jacob and sends him off to go find a wife in Padan Aram. And that is up what we would consider today as it's northeast of Israel in modern-day Turkey. So today, as we look at the story of Jacob and Esau, we're going to see the dysfunctional families experience division, discord, and distance. Dysfunctional families experience division, discord, and distance. And it is highly likely that as you look at your immediate family and your extended family, that you will find some division. You'll find that you have been distanced from some family members, or maybe there's an estranged brother or cousin or nephew or sister or something that has left the family, and they're out there and they don't really have contact, and it's been a long time since you've talked to this relative. It could be closer at home now. I mean, you've heard stories about moms and dads and kids getting into it. The kid leaves, and there's no communication, nothing. Totally shut down. For years, this goes on. Maybe you know somebody in your family, you're familiar with that situation. And it's tension, right? And maybe they do show up for Christmas or Thanksgiving. And when they do, nobody talks. It's tight. Tension is tight. And many times it takes tragedy to bring those family people back together. It takes mom dying or dad dying for them to come together and be reconciled. We don't want to wait that long. Jacob, when he's been sent away for 20 years, he stays in Padan Aram. 20 years. He doesn't see any of his immediate family during those 20 years. His mother, Rebecca, died while he was away. He did not get to return and come to her funeral even. This is some distance Jacob has put between he and his family. Will they be reconciled? Can they be reunited? What's it going to take for this family to come together and be healed? So in chapter 28, Isaac blesses Jacob and sends him off to Padan Aram, the home of Abraham. And Jacob, when he gets there, he sees this beautiful woman named Rachel. He wants to marry her. He gets her father's permission. And somehow, the father-in-law, Laban, I don't know how this works, but on their honeymoon night, he does the switcheroo. And instead of Rebecca, it's Leah, his oldest daughter, that he sleeps with and becomes his wife. So he finds out he's been tricked. The deceiver has been deceived. And he has to work 7 more years for his father-in-law in order to be able to marry Rebecca. Okay, that's kind of what's going on here in chapter 28. And 29 and 30. And Jacob is getting rich. His herds of sheep and goat and et cetera are growing. He's becoming very wealthy. He's a threat now to his father-in-law, Laban. So Jacob leaves. Jacob takes his family and all his animals and he leaves. And Laban chases him. And they meet up. And you think there's going to be this battle, this ugly scene, but they actually come to an agreement and said, look, yes, Jacob, your wives are my daughters. You got to know how much I love them, okay? I still want to see them. I want to be in touch with them. Please don't take them away from me. And Jacob says, you know what? I'm going to treat them well, but we're going. And so they agree to separate. And Jacob goes his own way, and Laban goes back to Padan Aram. So now we're going to fast forward to chapter 32 of Genesis. Chapter 32. And we're going to be reading, I have these scriptures up on the screen here, starting in verse 3 of chapter 32. Jacob sent messengers ahead of him to his brother Esau in the land of Seir, the country of Edom. He instructed them, "This is what you are to say to my lord Esau. Your servant Jacob says, I have been staying with Laban and have remained there till now. I have cattle and donkeys and sheep, goats, male and female servants. Now I am sending this message to my lord, that I may find favor in your eyes." When the messenger returned to Jacob, they said, "We went to your brother Esau, and now he is coming to meet you, and he has 400 soldiers with him." 400 is significant because that was the size of a militia in those days. What is going to happen? Well, here's Jacob's response. He's afraid. In fear and distress, Jacob decides to come up with this plan. He divides his people, right, the ones who were with him, into two camps, and the flocks and the herds and the camels as well. He thought, if Esau comes and attacks one group, hopefully the other group will escape from Esau. He expects Esau to live up to his word. I'm going to kill my brother Jacob. He expects that after 20 years, Esau is still angry. Esau is still upset. And Esau is going to come with an army. And he's going to take everything Jacob has and kill Jacob. Let's skip down to verse 13. This is Jacob. Jacob spent the night there. And from what he had with him, he selected a gift for his brother Esau. This is the gifts he's sending to Esau. 200 female goats, 20 male goats, 200 ewes and 20 rams, 30 female camels with their young, 40 cows and 10 bulls, and 20 female donkeys and 10 male donkeys. He put them in the care of his servants, each herd by itself. And he said to his servants, "Go ahead of me and keep some distance between the herds." He instructed the one in the lead, "When my brother Esau meets you and asks, 'Who do you belong to and where are you going? And who owns all these animals in front of you?' You are to be sure and say, 'Your servant Jacob is coming behind us.' You are to say, 'They belong to your servant Jacob. They are a gift to my lord Esau, and he is coming behind us.' He also instructed the second, the third, and all the others who followed the herds, 'You are to say the same thing to Esau when you meet him. And be sure to say, your servant Jacob is coming behind us.' For he thought, 'I will pacify him with these gifts I am sending on ahead. Later, when I see him, perhaps he will receive me.' So Jacob's gifts went on ahead of him, but he himself spent the night in the camp." So Jacob is being wise, maybe. He's thinking the worst. How can I survive this? He thinks he can pacify Esau with all this stuff. It's over 550 animals he's sending to Esau as a gift. This is the kind of gift you would give a king, not an estranged brother. So Jacob really wants to make a point here. See, I think Jacob is moving in the direction of reconciliation. I don't think he's just being coy or deceptive here. I think he's really trying to move into the direction of reconciliation. We're gonna listen to Genesis chapter 33, and the words will be up here on the screen, and we'll talk about it.
Chapter 33. Jacob looked up, and there was Esau coming with his 400 men. So he divided the children among Leah, Rachel, and the two maidservants. He put the maidservants and their children in front, Leah and her children next, and Rachel and Joseph in the rear. He himself went on ahead and bowed down to the ground 7 times as he approached his brother. But Esau ran to meet Jacob and embraced him. He threw his arms around his neck and kissed him, and they wept. Then Esau looked up and saw the women and children. "Who are these with you?" he asked. Jacob answered,
"They are the children God has graciously given your servant."
Then the maidservants and their children approached and bowed down. Next, Leah and her children came and bowed down. Last of all came Joseph and Rachel, and they too bowed down. Esau asked, "What do you mean by all these droves I met?"
"To find favor in your eyes, my lord,"
he said. But Esau said,
"I already have plenty, my brother. Keep what you have for yourself."
"No, please,"
said Jacob.
"If I have found favor in your eyes, accept this gift from me. For to see your face is like seeing the face of God, now that you have received me favorably. Please accept the present that was brought to you. For God has been gracious to me, and I have all I need."
And because Jacob insisted, Esau accepted it. Then Esau said,
"Let us be on our way. I'll accompany you."
But Jacob said to him,
"My lord knows that the children are tender and that I must care for the ewes and cows that are nursing their young. If they are driven hard just one day, all the animals will die. So let my lord go on ahead of his servant, while I move along slowly at the pace of the droves before me and that of the children, until I come to my lord in Seir."
Esau said,
"Then let me leave some of my men with you."
"But why do that?"
Jacob asked.
"Just let me find favor in the eyes of my lord."
So that day Esau started on his way back to Seir. Jacob, however, went to Succoth, where he built a place for himself and made shelters for his livestock. That is why the place is called Succoth. After Jacob came from Paddan Aram, he arrived safely at the city of Shechem in Canaan and camped within sight of the city. For 100 pieces of silver, he bought from the sons of Hamor, the father of Shechem, the plot of ground where he pitched his tent. There he set up an altar and called it El Elohe Israel.
Okay, so Jacob is moving in the direction of reconciliation here. And we see it in chapter 33 that we just read, but also part of chapter 32 that we skipped. And I want to bring your attention to five things that Jacob does to move in the direction of reconciliation. The first thing he does, he sends messengers. He is proactive. Now, to send messengers, remember, he's way up north. See the red Haran up there? That's Mount Haran, Padam Aram, where Jacob is. That's where all Abraham's family is. And down at the very bottom here, of the bottom of the Dead Sea, is Seir, the land of the Edomites, or the Seir Mountains. Okay, so Jacob is up there. 700 miles south is Esau. Got it? Now, Jacob, God told Jacob that he wants him to go back to the promised land. So this is the natural path. In fact, it says he went from Peniel to Shechem, to Bethel, to Bethlehem, and to Hebron. That's the path that Jacob and all his family and all his flocks are headed. So when he sends messengers to the south, messengers have to travel way far down here, 700 miles, if Esau is still in Seir. He may be somewhere, you know, in between, but the messengers go all the way down, and then the messengers come back as Jacob and his people are coming down to meet at Peniel, and he says Esau's on his way. So they're going like this, and they're going to meet in Peniel. So that's the plan. So Jacob says, I'm going to send messengers first. They're going to go ahead of me, and they're going to try to ease the way. And he says this. This is the message. I have cattle and donkey and sheep and goats and male servants and female servants. Why would he tell him that? He's not offering it to him yet. Now I'm sending this message to my Lord that I may find favor in your eyes. This is an opening window from Jacob to Esau to say, I confess I deceived you, and I took all the stuff that you should have gotten. I took your wealth. I took your blessing. This is a foretaste of what's coming. He's trying to soften the blow here, right? Trying to appease. Next thing he does is he humbly prays. Now, we didn't read this a while ago, but from chapter 32, then Jacob prayed, O God, my father Abraham, God of my father Isaac, Lord, you who said to me, go back to your own country and your relatives, and I will make you prosper. I am unworthy of the kindness and faithfulness you have shown your servant. I had only my staff when I crossed this Jordan, but now I have become two camps. Save me, I pray, from the hand of my brother Esau, for I am afraid he will come and attack me, and also the mothers with their children. So this is the first sign we've seen of Jacob trying to be humble, anything but proud and deceptive. He is here being humble and transparent and asking God for help and acknowledging that all his good gifts have come from God. So he humbly prays. Next, he sends the gifts. Like we said, over 550 gifts. These were the gifts that were meant for a king, not for an estranged relative. But this is Jacob moving in the steps of direction towards reconciliation. Notice several times he calls Esau Lord and refers to himself as servant. I didn't count how many times there were, but there were several times his messengers and when Jacob and Esau meet, it is Esau's the Lord, Jacob is the servant. So he humbles himself before his brother. And then when they do meet, Jacob bows down seven times. Again, that's not normal. Even if it's someone who really is higher than you, you maybe bow once, but seven times? He's acknowledging his own guilt, his own deceptiveness in the past. He's humbling himself, and he's asking Esau to forgive him, to accept all these gifts as kind of like restitution for all that Jacob took from him to begin with. So Jacob is moving in the direction of reconciliation, and the reunion is sweet. In fact, Jacob says, it's like I've seen the face of God, Esau. Our reunion is so sweet. Esau runs to Jacob when he sees him. I wonder what Jacob's thinking when Esau's running to him with 400 soldiers behind him. Oh, here he comes. He's going to whip out his sword and whoosh. But he doesn't. He just grabs him by the neck and he kisses him and they fall down together. And it's a beautiful reunion and they wept. Nobody said anything about the past. There's no word here about the past. All is forgiving. These brothers are reunited. They're reconciled. Esau accepts the gifts and he introduces them to all his family. And they all are embraced. Dysfunctional families experience division, discord, and distance. Healthy families pursue reunion, resolution, and reconciliation. Let that sink in. Look at your family. Is there distance between you and some family members? Is there dissonance, distance? How are you pursuing? You're chasing after. You're going in the direction of reconciliation. You're pursuing reunion and resolution and reconciliation. You know, before Jacob could do any of these five steps to in that direction, he had to wrestle with God. And we skipped that part of the story. And we don't have time to go and examine it. It's a really weird story, actually. God wrestles with the angel of God. But at that point, Jacob has changed. Jacob gets a new name when he wrestles with God. No longer is he Jacob. Now he's Israel. And he gets a new character. And from that, we see all these five steps Jacob pursues in the direction of reconciliation. So before you can just jump in and try to reconcile with a family member, you need to wrestle with God first. Because he's got to change your character. Otherwise, it's going to come out all wrong. I've told you about some things in my family. I shared with you the story of my Uncle Larry. This has been a while, but my Uncle Larry was killed in a drug deal, in a cocaine deal that went bad in Nashville. And he was killed by two teenagers, one 12 and one 17. Terrence, the 12-year-old, was the youngest to ever been convicted of murder in Davidson County. And I told you about my grandfather, Big Joe. I love my granddaddy and my grandmother. Big Joe led the way in our family of choosing to forgive these two boys. And there was hardly any time that went by before he did that. And he met with them. In fact, when the boys were going through the system of juvenile and adult prison, my granddad was right there lobbying for them in the courts that they be treated with leniency. It's an amazing story, but you haven't heard the whole story yet. You see, there was a family member there was distance between us. In fact, I did not even know this person existed until I was at the funeral home for visitation. And here comes what I found out to be my cousin, Angelia. And Angelia is going to come and share her side of the story.
I'm not used to using a mic. Can y'all hear me? Well, I know we all have stories, so thank you for giving me an opportunity to share a bit of mine. I certainly know about dysfunctional families, as Barry shared a little bit. My parents were teenagers when I was conceived. They were both rebellious teenagers. They were both drug addicts. And they never married. I was raised by my mother's parents, who had adopted her as a child, so I had no blood relatives around that I knew of. And my mother and I, we never had a relationship to speak of. Because of all of her problems, she moved in and out of our home. I knew her, but we didn't have a mother-daughter relationship. And I didn't know my father at all. No one in my family would speak of him. They did not answer any of the questions that I had, and I didn't even know his name. But my grandparents always took me to church. We were Sunday morning, Sunday night, Wednesday night people. Not a lot of that carried over into the home, but I was in church quite a bit. And from a very young age, I got to know my Heavenly Father very well. And that really filled the void that I had. Not having parents, though, did create an emptiness in me. And it was one that my grandparents couldn't fill, especially because they were trying to keep everything secret. They really didn't want me to know anything about my father. And there were a lot of secrets, a lot of lies, a lot of anger. Like if I asked questions, they would get angry. And I didn't understand any of it. So it was very confusing. But I finally did get to know who my father was when I was 14 and he called just out of the blue. And it was a strange conversation. He didn't tell me right away that he was my dad, but I knew that this was something was weird. And I figured out pretty quickly who he was and what was going on. And when I told my grandparents about it, they became very concerned and worried. And then my mother stepped in, and immediately they tried to squash this. They didn't want me to have a relationship with him. They said hurtful things like, he denied you when you were a baby. He never wanted you. You were a mistake. He's a bad person. He's a drug addict. And you can't trust him. You shouldn't have anything to do with him. Stay away. But I was too curious. So I disobeyed. And I would see him or talk to him any chance that I could. That wasn't very often. Maybe just a handful of times in my teenage years. And it wasn't all very good either. A lot of times, if we talked, he was intoxicated. Sometimes he'd make plans to see me and then not show up. So there was a lot of disappointment and constant hurt going on there. When I was 20, I worked in a pharmacy in Nashville at St. Thomas Hospital. And I was trying to apply for financial aid to go to college. And I'd reached out to him and asked if he would help me, if he would give me his tax information so I could put that down. To apply for financial aid. He came to see me at work, and he did not bring what I had asked him for. Instead, he brought a prescription for pain medication that he had stolen from his doctor and forged. Luckily, the pharmacist that I worked for believed me that I had nothing to do with that, that I didn't know that it was fake and that I wasn't a part of it. But I was very hurt and very, very angry and embarrassed. He was arrested for that. And he later sent me a letter of apology, a very heartfelt letter, explaining his drug addiction, explaining his remorse. It was a true apology, but I didn't respond. I kind of wanted to forgive him because I had forgiven a lot already, but not right away. I was 20, and I came up with a plan. I knew where the bar was that he frequented, and I thought, when I turn 21, I'm just going to start going there. I'll just go there all the time. And he's going to have to deal with me. he can't avoid me. He can't stand me up anymore. He's going to see me. And we're going to work this out. I'll forgive him, and I'll help him get clean and sober, and we'll have this great relationship, and we'll have a great story. But that's not how things turned out. 8 days before my 21st birthday, he was murdered, and I learned about it in the paper. And I had never forgiven him. I'd intended to, but I didn't follow through. So I didn't know the rest of my family. I had a half-brother that I had learned about and had met a few times, too. I did know him, but I didn't know the rest of the family. The grief that I felt at that time is really hard to explain because it's not somebody I had a very close relationship with. But I hurt, and I grieved. And later on in my life, a psychologist would explain to me that I was grieving the loss of hope. Loss of what could have been, and that's a very real grief too. And I also had all this guilt for holding on to that resentment and not forgiving, like I knew I was called to do, like I had done in the past, and like I wanted to do. Now he was gone, and I didn't have that opportunity. So I did some wrestling with God, and I prayed, and I decided to go to the funeral all by myself, but I was scared. I was really afraid. I didn't know who knew me and who didn't. I knew that I was a secret, that I was a dark secret in his family. I didn't want to hurt anyone. I was concerned that people would be angry at me for showing up, or they would be embarrassed. I didn't know how they would react. I thought maybe I could just kind of go in and quietly come in and say my piece and then leave. My whole purpose was I wanted to somehow try to apologize and forgive my dead father. So what I did was I went and I wrote a letter. I wrote a letter of forgiveness, and I put it in an envelope, and on the outside I wrote, to my father, and I put it in his casket. What I didn't think about was that someone would see that letter and think it was for them. So Big Joe saw the letter, my dad's dad, and he thought it was for him. Makes sense. So he read it, and then he came to find me. And immediately, he embraced me, and he just showered me with love, and he took me to meet the whole family. I mean, we're talking at the funeral home, like in that moment, then and there. I think it was the next day or 2 days later, my Aunt Sissy came to me, and she had stayed up all night putting together a photo album of every member of our family and their name and how they were related to me. Your cousin Barry, you know, your Aunt Martha. They just made me family immediately. There was complete reconciliation from the start. I quit going to college for a little bit, and I moved in with my grandparents to get to know them. We spent 2 years together in the court system going through the homicide trials for these two boys. And what I've said to so many people is that my grandfather was Christ personified for me. Every biblical principle that I had learned in church growing up, I now saw put into practice for the first time. I saw forgiveness. I saw mercy. I saw community service. He took time to explain or try to understand these boys' lives and their background and what maybe led them to this situation. I learned how to look at people differently, how to try to consider what someone might have gone through to cause them to behave the way they do, and to just feel compassion for people. And like Jacob, I got a new name, only it only stayed in that family. We spent a lot of time together. We would go out to restaurants. We would play Scrabble every Wednesday night. I was always with my grandparents just trying to soak up as much time and love and fill that void. And they really did make up for everything that I had lacked in my childhood. It was filled and overflowing. Big Joe was a very social man. He did not know a stranger. I know you hear that about people, but this was so true. We would go to a restaurant. He would eat as fast as he could, and then he would get up and go talk to the people in the restaurant. Or we would go to the Parthenon Park or Centennial Park, and they would have a big band night, and he would go and he would pass out church fans to everybody and ask them where they went to church. But anybody he would talk to, if I was there, he would say, "Do you want to hear the greatest love story ever told?" And he would tell them our story. If they would listen, he would tell them about the death of his son and how when he was hurt and going through the hardest time in his life, God sent him an angel. And he never once called me Angelia. He only called me Angel. Now, my family will tell you I'm not an angel, but knowing how much you love your children, I can now, as a parent, see a little glimpse of what he felt at that time. So God has always been the only father that I have ever needed. But I am so incredibly grateful that he finally did grant my desire to have a tangible, physical family here on earth, a loving family. It took 20 years, just like Jacob was estranged from his family for 20 years. It was 20 years for me as well. But God's timing is always perfect. And through this experience, I have learned to value truth above all else, because I can tell you that no matter how ugly the truth is, it is always less painful than a lie. And I've also learned to be quick to forgive. It is the fastest way to healing for whatever has hurt you, and God will always bless it. Thank you.
Angelia did nothing wrong, but she was still distanced from her family. And she still needed to be reconciled. And there was a lot of fear involved in showing up at that funeral home. And Angelia, like Jacob, had to wrestle with God. And she pursued the path of reconciliation. What about you? Are you estranged from your family? Is there a family member that you don't talk to anymore? Follow Angelia's example. Follow Jacob's example. Go out of your way to reach out to that person so you can be reunited, so you can have resolution, and so you can be reconciled That's what healthy families and healthy people do. Now, I'm not going to guarantee you that if you do this, it's all going to come out well. I can't give you that guarantee, but it's still the right thing to do. I want to encourage you to do that and take those steps. Or maybe you need to come along somebody else who needs to take those steps and encourage them to go in the direction of reconciliation. Let's stand together and we'll pray. And if anyone would like to pray together with me or the shepherds, we'll be in the back of the room while we sing this song. Come on back and we'd be glad to pray with you. Father God, you are the great reconciler. You are the one who approached us and wrestled with us. You are the one who sent Jesus first, who first loved us. And we just want to follow your example, God. As you reconciled us back to you, we want to be reconciled to our family. We want to be reconciled to people we work with, people we go to school with, people on our team. Wherever reconciliation needs to happen, Lord, we want to wrestle with you and we want to follow your example. We pray this in Christ's name. Amen. Let's see.